So it is my great honor and pleasure tonight to introduce Dr. Vandana Shiva. I could go on and on and on and on and on about Dr. Shiva, but I will not. But I will tell you some of the things I think are the most important. So Dr. Shiva is a doctor of physics, but she's also a doctor of the philosophy of science, which I found very interesting. And she has been able to combine all of these things together, also being an environmental activist, ecologist, author, world speaker and leader. She was given the prestigious Right Livelihood Award, which is the alternative Nobel Prize, in 1993. She was named one of the 5 most important women in Asia and one of the most 7 most powerful women in the world by the Forbes magazine in 2010. She is the founder and director of Navdanya International, which is a national movement in India to protect the diversity and integrity of living resources, organic farming, and fair trade. Over the past 20 years, she has started over 100 seed banks in India. She has trained over 650,000 farmers to be seed savers. And practice sustainable agriculture. She is a visionary and serves as a visionary leader for world governments across the globe and contributes to numerous food and agriculture, women's rights, and social justice movements worldwide. She is currently advising the country of Bhutan on how to become the first wholly organic nation in the world. So we are indeed humbled and honored to have you here this evening, Dr. Shiva. We know you have traveled so far to come. Please, a very warm aloha for Dr. Vandana Shiva.
Thank you very much. Thank you to all of you. And I have to say thank you to this amazing plant. I want to thank the farmers who grew the wonderful food we were served, and the chefs and the cooks, and all of you who've been organizing. I was told you're a very small island with a very small population. It doesn't look like it when you stand in this hall. But I also want to thank those of you who came up to talk to me about what the GMO trials and the seed production and the spraying of poisons is doing to your communities. And I think your island is truth, speaking to the world, that GMOs are an extension of pesticides, not a substitute and alternative to it. Because the myth was, oh, pesticides are horrible, and that is why we have to do genetic engineering so you never have to spray. The early ads of GMOs were, farmers will never have to spray again. We know through the practice in the rest of the world that in fact the spraying increases, and Andy talked about it. But you see it in your daily lives, that GMOs are not a safe alternative to poisons. They are pushed by a poison industry to increase the sale of both the poisons and simultaneously monopolize the seed. And as you talked, My mind went back to 1984, when the worst industrial disaster of the world took place, 2nd December night, in the city of Bhopal. It's just called the Bhopal disaster. 3,000 people were killed by the leak of a gas from that pesticide plant immediately. 30,000 have died since then. Most of them were poor because the factory was near slums with the poor state. And I remember a poster of the 60s which had an advertisement of Union Carbide, the company whose plant it was, with a beaker pouring liquid over a landscape where a farmer is plying their field. And interestingly, the beaker had a red liquid, and it says, carbide will have a hand in India's future. Of course, they were trying to make it look like it's going to create miracles in agriculture. And what it left us with was with the Bhopal disaster. And the disaster didn't stop in 84. Generations being born today are being born crippled. And two of the women activists of Bhopal, you know, I remember, and they haven't given up their struggle for justice to date. I was with them on the anniversary in 2012. They haven't given up their struggle. They were young women, 26 years ago, much younger. But when they were given a prize, an award for protection of the environment, they took that award and set up a hospital for the children who are being born crippled. And with a little bit of the award, they created an award for other women who were fighting to protect the planet. They call it the Chingari Award. Chingari means that one spark that creates a fire. But Bhopal isn't the only poison tragedy of India. About 2 years ago, reports started to come from the state of Kerala, tiny little part of it, which grows cashew. And they've been spraying pesticides on the cashew plantations. Of course, it was going into the water, it was going into the wells, it was being sprayed on children. 1,000 people have died in Kerala. It's called the endosulfan tragedy. Endosulfan was a pesticide made by Bayer, but it's now out of patent, so a lot of Indian companies also make it. And interestingly, Union Carbide has been bought up by Dow, which Andy said is one of the most criminal industries. Chemicals were first introduced in the name of the Green Revolution in the state of Punjab. And the Green Revolution was given a Nobel Peace Prize. In the 80s, same year, 1984, we had an eruption of violence in Punjab, literally a civil war, an extremism and terrorism, which also killed 30,000 people. The narrative was these miracle chemicals and these miracle seeds are going to create so much prosperity that there will never ever be rural discontent. India will not have a red revolution, and therefore this is the green revolution. And what we got was a very bloody revolution with discontent rising. And the farmers started to say, this was, you know, Punjab was a land of prosperous farmers. Why were they prosperous? Actually, my mother's foster father used to be the governor of that area, which under British rule was called the Northwestern Provinces. And you know, the British entered, the East India Company came in first through Bengal. And the first thing they did was change land ownership laws, exactly in the form that I witness here in Hawaii. Gave the land to large landowners, and the objective of agriculture became make industrial raw materials, sugarcane, indigo for the cotton industry, cotton, and rent collection from the land. It was called Zamidari. So Chotaram, my mother's foster father, realized what was happening and had a law passed in these northwestern provinces as governor. He's the one who insisted that my mother go to university, that she educate herself, and helped her throughout to say women are equal. And she was more than equal. The law said something very simple, that no peasant's land can ever be alienated, no matter how high the debt. The land, the homestead, and the animals, which in India are very important, that they could never be taken away. So in the East, you started to get this depression and poverty as land was appropriated from the peasants. And in the West, the peasants stayed the owner-cultivators. And that is why when the poisons were brought, they were brought to Punjab and not to Bengal, because these were prosperous farmers. They were independent farmers. And in fact, and I believe small farmers are the last independent producers of the world, which is why there's such desperation to wipe them out. In the early days when the US industrial agriculture policies were being made, I remember reading that one of the senators had written, we've got to squeeze the last farmer off the land like we squeeze the toothpaste out of a tube. And that was always the policy, because the sources of independence are a major threat to a system that is about control. So when, within 10 years, the Punjab farmers were starting to feel enslaved because they couldn't grow what they wanted to grow. They had to grow rice and wheat. They couldn't grow it in their own way. They had to use the chemicals. The water that was released for their fields wasn't decided by them or their region. It was decided in Delhi, because the Green Revolution meant a centralization of everything: water supply, price, input decisions, credit. And then they wrote, they said, we are enslaved by this system. And they revolted. They revolted with the gun. 1984, that forced Indira Gandhi to send the army into Punjab and the Golden Temple, and then she was assassinated by, I think 30th of November, she was assassinated. Same year, all of this, 1984. Now, unlike many of you, I've never attended a single class in biology. Never. They wanted us to cut up cockroaches, and I thought it was so unnecessary. So I went into the safe zone of physics. But I was forced in 1984 to ask, why is this model of agriculture so violent? Why are people being killed in Punjab? Why are people being killed in Bhopal? What is this thing called the Green Revolution? And I studied it like I would study quantum theory, and found out a number of things that even I hadn't realized before I spent 2 years of researching for the United Nations. The first thing I found out was, actually these chemicals weren't ever designed for growing food. They were designed for killing people. And that's why they kill in Punjab. That's why they harm on your island. Most pesticides started out as war chemicals. Even chemical fertilizers have their roots in the war, because it's the explosive factories that were refurbished to start making fertilizers. And if you just take your mind back, you remember the Oklahoma bombings? What was the bomb? Fertilizer bomb. Oslo, when that young crazy man piled up so much fertilizer and then blew up the official buildings. Fertilizer bomb. Every bombing, terrorist bombing in India, fertilizer bomb. And for some reason I was at, you know, some gathering, and there was a senior security person from the US who, and I'd given a talk over dinner about why industrial agriculture is so wrong. And he came up to me and said, I hadn't realized it. You know, when we wanted to counter the Soviets, we distributed sacks and sacks of fertilizers to the Afghans. And now they're making bombs to kill us. What the Afghanis have is the fertilizers that were given by the US government and the CIA. So a century of war making and destruction is behind the challenges we face. Interestingly, some of the poisons were designed to kill people in the concentration camps and gas chambers. They were nerve gases. They were then modified into pesticides. And I was just thinking, while some of you were meeting me while over dinner, you know, they had the Nuremberg trials. But who was tried? The poor guard who opened the door. Maybe an official. And Andy said we should go to the source. Look at who's throwing the babies into the river. The companies that were making those poisons for the Nazis to kill the Jews are the companies thriving today as the agrochemical industry now mutated into the biotech industry. It's the same. And I decided today, and this is my commitment to you. I don't know how long it'll take. Might be take 2 years, might take 3 years. We are going to organize new Nuremberg trials for these criminals. And bring together every community that has been harmed by this continued war in the name of agricultural progress. The people from Kauai, people from Bhutan, Bhopal, the farmers of India. Now, I was woken up to biotechnology partly as a result of my work on the Green Revolution. We live in such a strange world. You can have farmed all your life and you'll never be called an expert. You write one book and you become an expert. So I used this stupidity to start going to conferences where I was invited to give a talk to understand deeper what is happening. And one of these early conferences was organized by a dear common friend of Andy's and mine. And it was the Dag Hammarskjöld Foundation of Sweden that organized it. But Pat Mooney pitted in a lot. And that conference was called Laws of Life, the Emerging Biotechnologies. And all of these companies that are here on our island were there. Not Monsanto, because it was not a big player at that time. It started to buy up biotech companies later. The big players were what are now called Syngenta. And I remember the representative of Sibagayagiri said, we are too small. We've got to be bigger and we'll be five companies at the turn of the century controlling health and food. Five companies. That's the day I decided I was going to start saving seeds. Because the same conference, they talked about how it was not fair that farmers save seeds. And how they needed intellectual property laws to make seed saving a crime and seed their property. So the Siba Gaigi person said, we are too small. Siba joined with Sandoz to become Novartis and then joined with AstraZeneca and AstraZeneca to become Syngenta. If you look at the map of concentration now over the seed supply, most independent seed companies have gone. And as Nancy mentioned, most public breeding is gone. And they would like the last farmer to have no independence in seed. Therefore, one of the big fights we have is to prevent the criminalization of seed saving by farmers. So first we were lied to and told that without chemical fertilizers and pesticides we couldn't have food. And now we're being lied to and told without GMOs we can't have food. And how could it be that a death industry could reincarnate itself as the life sciences industry? That's what they call themselves. Because part of what the agenda is to redefine life as their property, their invention, and just a bundle of molecules and genes. No, Monsanto is on record in saying that these intellectual property rights laws that were imposed on the world that forced patents on life, that they were the patient, they were the diagnostician, and they were the physician in writing them. They defined the problem. And for them, the problem was farmers are saving seeds, and they offered a solution. It should now onwards be treated as a crime. And I don't remember, do you remember, Andy? We got together in Penang as a NEEM team. Because 94, let me backtrack. 84, we have the Bhopal disaster. And my mother, grandmother have always used a beautiful tree called the neem. Indian name is, its scientific name is Azadirachta indica. I always thought, you know, Linnaeus, the Swedish taxonomist, he gave all the scientific names. I thought this might have been his too. It turns out Azadirachta is a Persian name. Because the travelers from the Persia, when they came to India, they found this tree that was just amazing. It's in India, we call it the village pharmacy. 1,000 uses, including pest control. And it doesn't even kill the pest. Just slows it down a bit. So it can't reproduce fast enough. And that's how you control it. Totally non-violent pest control. And humans can eat it. Animals can eat it. So I carried saplings of the neem to Bhopal. As soon as we were allowed to travel to Bhopal, it took 3 days before they cleared the airport and said, yes, you can now land. And I took bucketfuls of saplings and painted by hand a poster which said, no more Bhopal's, plant a neem. 10 years. And we spent, you know, every village we'd take, we'd show farmers how to make a spray for pest control. In any case, when you know, when you put your silk away, you put a few neem leaves. In our seed containers, we put neem leaves, put in a little bit of neem oil. And 94, we find the neem has been patented for use of pest control. I didn't realize it was patented because the journal only said the world's first invention of neem as a pesticide. I said, what? I've seen my grandmother do it. I've seen my mother do it. Where did this invention come from? Turned out that it was not just a trademark, it was a patent. And there were many patents, but one was jointly held by the U.S. Department of Agriculture and a company called W.R. Grace, which became infamous for the poisoning of the groundwater outside Boston, and a film and a book came out called The Civil Action about housewives rising against the leukemia that spread because of the toxins. So, as a result of all of this neem discussion, on the one hand, we filed a case. We filed a case in the European Patent Office and the U.S. Patent Office. And I filed it with Jeremy. And when we put this challenge, the question asked was, what's your commercial interest? We said, we don't have a commercial interest, we have a public interest. They said, sorry, doesn't count. Only commercial competitors can bring challenges to patents. The public can't. But in Europe, they have a clause for the public interest and ethical issues, and we were able to bring it. We fought the case 11 years, and we defeated the biggest superpower of the world.
You're listening to KKCR Hanalei, KAQA Kilauea, your community radio station, island-wide on Kauai.
Linda Bullard, who became the president of the International Federation of Organic Agriculture Movements, only to keep GMOs out of organic standards, and worked very hard to ensure that was the case. And Magda Alwet, the president of the Greens. The Greens are significant in Europe. The three of us, we've grown, become friends over time, and, you know, we had the people, we had the knowledge. I'd collected 100,000 signatures for the case. Linda was in Europe, Magda was in Europe, and for 11 years we could sustain this case just through love and friendship. And that's why I never underestimate the power of love and friendship. And I remember in one of the hearings, this U.S. government lawyer is pointing to me like this. She has no business to be in this room. She's not European. So I just smiled and said, neither are you. Because, you know, in patriarchy, there's this, you know, commonality. You know, we're all bosses of the world. We are the rulers and owners of the world. We are one. And of course, the judge said, yes, that's true. You're American. She's Indian. Then there's a common interest that brings them here, and you have your commercial interest to defend. Now, the Neem was our first biopiracy case. But then there was the basmati. I come from the valley in India, from the Himalaya, where basmati, which means the queen of aroma. I notice you don't have too much rice here because you've got the taro. Why should you have rice? But, you know, you normally basmati is now everywhere available. And they always will say Dehraduni basmati. Can't be, because our valley is tiny. You know, it's 20 miles by 60 miles. And only a tiny part of it will grow the basmati, this aromatic rice. The same seeds I take across the mountains, down to the plains, the aroma's not there. Because it's not just in the genes, it's in the relationship of the genes, the plant, the soil, the climate. So when we started the big movement against the basmati patent, because a Texas company called RiceTech claimed to have invented the plant, the grain, the aroma, methods of cooking, we filed cases in India to get the government to mobilize. But I also went to the U.S. and we started in the U.S. And I have to say, you know, the only people available to take up this fight at that time were old church ladies. And they were adorable. They marched with me to RiceTech headquarters, hands off the basmati. And more importantly, we had a postcard campaign that said, USPTO, US Patent and Trademark Office, if you don't repeal this patent, we will have to rename you the US Piracy and Theft Office. And then comes along Monsanto, which we now know started patenting, created the patenting of seeds through the WTO, now going around and patenting non-GM crops. The interesting thing is, and you made the point about patent law only being about manufacture and assembly of man-made molecules or parts of mechanical things. When we were fighting the basmati patent, one of the things I did was build a common alliance between Pakistan and India, because we both grow basmati. We went to every ambassador of the WTO in Geneva. And I went to meet the US ambassador to WTO. said, I mean, this is a shame, you know. Basmati's been around, we grow it. This is piracy. And you know what he turned around and told me? We cannot challenge this patent because for us, redefining life forms as manufacture is the only basis of a future American economy. I would suggest to all of you, try and find an article in Forbes magazine, 6th of November. I think it's last year, maybe it's the year before. And it's a one-page article, Why Uncle Sam Loves Frankenfoods. It's a Forbes analysis. And it's got the positive trade balances and the negative trade balances. On everything, the United States of America has a negative trade balance. Your shoes, your slippers, your Apple computers, everything is coming from China. Everything is coming from China. The only thing that's leaving the United States is patented seeds that collect royalties around the world and GMO crops. And that's why there's this desperation. And that's why you are critical to this issue, not just for your own sakes, but for the sake of the world. Because you've become like the nerve center for the expansion of this destruction. Andy's already mentioned how so many of the claims made about GMOs are false, as were the earlier claims about pesticides. Yeah? DDT will save the world. Yeah? There used to be jingles about it, you know. What a better life through chemistry. But in this long period, I remember, they genetically engineered a bull called Herman. And Herman had human growth genes. And they said, oh, now we can get human milk from cows, which will be the daughters of Herman. You know, the baby food movement is very strong. They said, just like your canned fake milk substitutes were not food, this is not human milk. Overnight, Herman became the source of an HIV vaccine. That's how quickly they can change the objective of their research. And you remember Dolly the sheep? Well, the owner of the company that was working on this had earlier engineered a sheep called Tracy. And when I was debating him, he said sheep are just furry little factories. And now they're mammalian bioreactors. Mammalian bioreactors meant that in their mammary glands, they will produce the chemicals you want. In this particular case, it was a human protein. So they had to clone Tracy. And talking about how unreliable the technology is, we only got the story of Tracy and the cover magazine of Time, of Newsweek, of everything have this image, the creator and the created. Ian Wilmot, the scientist, was the creator, and Dolly the sheep was the created. Dolly survived. 272 of her sisters either died or were born crippled. Without eyes, 3 ears, no legs. You never heard that. And of course, Dolly now is in a museum. Poor thing, she's dead too. She is stuffed in a museum. So if we start to count the failures, 85, I had a debate with the person from the World Bank who pushed chemicals on India. And he said, we don't have to worry about the harm of chemicals. We don't have to worry about toxics in soils. We don't have to worry about anything because now we have the next miracle. With genetic engineering, we will grow food on the moon, on toxic dumps, and in the Sahara Desert. And yet, all they can find is your rich, fertile island. Why aren't they doing these experiments on the moon? There definitely hasn't been more food, the issue of failure to yield, no reduction of chemicals, and such an ineffective technology that the two things they came up with was BT crops to control pests and herbicide-resistant crops to control weeds, and they've given us super pests and super weeds. And I would recommend that you go to the Navdanya website, www.navdanya, N-A-V-D-A-N-Y-A, which means nine seeds, but it also means the new gift. For us, the new gift is the gift of the commons, the gift of reclaiming life in freedom. And we did a report, along with the Center for Food Safety. We produced a report a year ago because we were getting fed up with the industry lies, to see what's really happening on the ground. And we asked movements and scientists off the place of Argentina, of Brazil, of Canada, North America, everywhere across the world. And finally were forced to give the title, The GMO Emperor Has No Clothes. You remember the story of the emperor without clothes? Where only a child had the courage to say, but the emperor is naked. And in that sense, we all have to be children, to have the courage to speak the truth and the clarity to speak the truth. Over the last 25 years, as we've been saving seeds, as we've been training farmers, growing food ecologically with biodiversity, because we didn't begin with bringing an organic produce to the market. That wasn't why Navdanya was founded. We began with protecting and defending the diversity and integrity of life. And for us, the idea of patenting and owning seed was wrong, and that's why the very founding principles of Navdanya is we do not recognize patents on life. We do not recognize patents on seed. And the other aspect was we've seen the Green Revolution failure, and we're not going to get to go for an even more lethal experiment with the planet through genetic engineering. So for us, the objective was saving seeds. And the only way we could actually save seeds as living and not as a museum was to grow them. And once the farmers had been trained to grow them, because farmers that had got used to using chemicals, the only way you could get them to use these seeds was by making them realize the benefits of organic. And once they'd grown this amazing stuff, you know, we call a whole family of crops we used to eat forgotten foods that are not being eaten anymore. Because global trade is a very pathetic trade. It can't deal with diversity. Monopolies and monocultures go together. And so we trade in eight commodity products. And everywhere agribusiness would like to reduce our diets to that. But it's not even that they're growing these crops for food. Food is an afterthought. Animal feed is the first priority. Biofuel is the second. Leftovers come to human beings. And it's such a hugely wasteful system. This is now coming out, that the system is a waste-creating system. First, it wastes the rich earth, leaving it poisoned. It wastes human communities by displacing them, destroying them. It wastes the potential of the land to produce. It then imposes uniformity to say, no, if taro, no, you can't have diverse crops. It'll only grow in one way. So the rest of you are waste. And then they ship it thousands of miles in Walmart trucks, which for transport must have uniformity, for their shelves must have uniformity, and must have a best before date, so half the food gets thrown away. 50% of the food is being wasted after it's produced. In my view, 50% of the food is being wasted in the process of being produced, because we are not using the potential of the land. How many things this island can grow for food? We tasted it today, and there's no reason to be importing 90% of your food. So we have laboriously been working on the productivity of biodiverse ecological farming. And we measure the health and nutrition output per acre, because that's what food is supposed to be about, providing nutrition. Not the weight of what you produce that gets into container ships. And what we find is biodiverse systems produce in certain aspects 10 times, 30 times, 40 times. I mean, I could read you the tables. And we're having so many deficiencies, you wouldn't have any of those deficiencies of magnesium, which leads to attention deficit disorder, or calcium, which is part of the reason the metabolic processes are getting blocked. All of the iron. You grow crops with the iron, you grow crops with all these nutrients, you're going to have the balanced nutrition. Your soil will have the balanced nutrition because you share the food with the soil. We have a very beautiful ancient Upanishad called the Taittiriya Upanishad. And it's only about food. Ancient text, only about food. And it says, everything is food. Everything is something else's food. So, you know, usually they make this pyramid where the humanity is on top. But in the food web, the microorganisms, we are their food. So in the web of life, which is a food web, there is no hierarchy. They're cycles. The constant recycling of nutrients to create the life that we have, not in poison, poverty, disease, but in abundance and generosity. Now, the first GM crop that was brought to India was the BT cotton. And in fact, it was the Bhopal tragedy that was used to say, oh, carbaryl, the pesticide used on cotton, killed so many people. Now we're going to bring a genetically modified plant which will never need pesticides. What has the BT cotton done? Pushed 270,000 farmers, more than a quarter million, to suicide because of the debt related to the royalties that get collected when seed is genetically modified and patented. That's why not only are patents on seed immoral, they are an instrument of war and genocide. A quarter million is not a small number. You know, the entire UN system shakes up and 1,000 people are killed somewhere for ethnic cleansing. And here there's an ethnic cleansing of the largest group of producers in the world, farmers. And if they have their way, they'd like to make the last farmer disappear, like they'd like the last seed to disappear, the last bee to disappear. And just as an aside, I'm thinking, 92 is, you know, the GATT is being negotiated. We've got hold of the treaty, 91. It was called the Dunkel draft text. We called it the DDT, and he said it's toxic. And I went around the country training farmers about what free trade would mean. And we had rallies of 500,000 people coming out. 92, the farmers asked me, what do you think we should really be worrying about? I said, A, patents, and currently in trade, Cargill. Cargill was setting up a seed plant and had distributed sunflower seeds. Cargill no more exists in seed. It has been eaten up by Monsanto everywhere outside the US. Cargill seeds is now Monsanto. So I told the farmers about what this was about. And so when the seed failed, something else had also happened. You had a trade negotiator called Carla Hills. And Carla Hills had come to India and said, till this economy is open for our corporations, we're going to use the crowbar to open up India's economy for U.S. corporations. And I'd shared this with the farmers. So they turn up at this seed factory with crowbars. And they literally dismantled stone by stone the entire factory and said, Carla Hills, you can open up the market. We will also pack up your companies and send them back home.
But I remember this Kargil story largely because after all this happened and then all of the Kargil chiefs descended on Bangalore and held a press conference attacking us and said we were very stupid because we weren't smart enough to realize that they were bringing new technologies that prevented the bees from usurping the pollen. And before that, in the Convention on Biological Diversity, the Monsanto representatives in defending and promoting the herbicide-resistant crops would say, we now have a technology that prevents the weeds from stealing the sunshine. So you've got bees stealing the pollen, biodiversity stealing sunshine, and farmers stealing seed when they save it. Everyone is a thief in their worldview because they are thieves. And every time we've organized and joined hands and cooperated and built solidarity, we've made them run. Andy shared you the stories of the U.S. I did sue Monsanto when they entered with the BT cotton because, as you said, Walter, they sneak in. They don't come through legal processes because they wouldn't be allowed to. So they sneak in. So I sued them for sneaking in. And then in 2010... the BT toxic gene had been put into the eggplant, which is native to India, and we have 4,500 varieties. And I realized this, you know, they go for the eggplant in India, the corn in Mexico, the taro here. Because it's not about technology, it is about conquest. And when you want to conquer, you hit the sacred. That's why every time colonialism has come, it's destroyed sacred shrines. And then put churches. All over the world. And as Andy says, you know, if this kind of technology is the new religion, that imposing it on the sacred biodiversity and the sacred culture of our food has to be the pattern they will follow. But we'd organized for 5 years since they started the trials. I remember at dinner, we had 130 dishes of eggplant. Even the dessert was eggplant. And our children had been involved, and it was the government was forced to organize public hearings in 7 big cities like this. Anyone could come and speak about why they wanted to or didn't want. Now, Monsanto is so foolish, when they send their bought up farmers, they send them in identical t-shirts. So it was always very clear, that corner is Monsanto. And the environment minister was going to give the decision on the basis of these public hearings on the 10th of February, I think it was. On 9th of February, I get a call from the U.S. Embassy. Would I meet a person called Nancy Fedorov, another Nancy? And would I meet her? I said, sure. And then I did quick homework. Who's this Nancy Fedorov? She was the advisor to the state, Secretary of State on spreading biotech in the world. And she was flying in to influence the decision. The environment minister preponed his decision and announced a moratorium. But the other point that happened was there was a snowstorm in Washington that prevented Nancy from arriving in time to influence the decision. And that's why when the opening songs we hear, We Are the Many, when I think of We Are the Many, I don't just think of the 7 billion human beings on this planet. I think of the 300 million species on the planet. And we are truly the many if we would keep that consciousness in mind and that the forces of creation and the universe will work with us because we are working to serve them. We're being guided by them. Through these many years, we've evolved in Navdanya under the larger umbrella of the recognition that we are part of the web of life and part of the earth family, And we have a beautiful word in Sanskrit for it, Vasudeva Kutumbakam, the family of the earth. And in the family of the earth, humans aren't the only creatures. And we are human to the extent we realize we are living among many creatures, equal to us. And within that, we then follow Gandhi, who gave us four words beginning with S. The first is Swaraj. You can't have freedom till you rule yourself. And when he talked about ruling yourself, he meant every individual. You can only rule yourself if you're grounded within yourself. You know who you are. And then as community. And then as countries. Swaraj. Swa means self. Raj means to govern. So self-organized freedom is how plants grow, how seeds renew, how the planet organizes itself. And that's how our freedom is created. And he recognized that you can't have this kind of freedom if for every activity of yours you're dependent on buying your food, buying your clothing, buying your electricity, buying this, buying that. So Swadeshi, self-making, was his second road to freedom. And that's why he pulled out the spinning wheel. And it was inspired by the spinning wheel that I started saving seeds. And, you know, I drew a matrix. I'm a physicist, so I think in those terms. First Industrial Revolution, textile industry, what did they control? How did we get freedom? Second Industrial Revolution, we kind of missed it with the chemical poisons. Third Industrial Revolution, the biotech industry, the raw material life forms. So what's the spinning wheel of today? The seed. And Navdanya was started with that. But Gandhi didn't just stop at creating freedom, but defending the space for freedom and defending in a highly equitable way. Sarvodaya, the uplifting of all, the last person. And he had a beautiful, he called it his talisman. When you want to know how any action of yours impacts the world, bring to your mind the face of the most vulnerable person. Think of what it will do to them. If it will harm them, don't take the action. If it will bring welfare to them, then go ahead and do it. So it's his talisman of the last person. And I extend it to say the talisman of the last being. But to me, the magic of Gandhi was Satyagraha, the fight for truth. He practiced it in South Africa. He practiced it where the equivalent of your sugarcane plantations were introduced in the cultivation of indigo. Farmers weren't allowed to grow food. They had to grow indigo, the blue dye, before the chemicals were found. And he was brought there. When he came back to India from South Africa, he was taken there by a freedom movement. And he lived there. And he went village to village. And he found women feeding the textile industry, having no clothes of their own. Just like today, farmers are feeding the global food system, not eating and going hungry. And he started what is called the Champaran Satyagraha, because the place was Champaran. We would rather die than grow indigo. We will stop growing indigo. And that's how peasants got liberated from the forced indigo cultivation. In 1930, the British said, wow, we can make so much money out of salt. I've just been gifted beautiful salt. And they passed a salt law saying, Indians can't make salt. They had to buy from the British. So Gandhi walked to the beach, picked up the salt from the sea, and said, nature gives it for free. We need it for our survival. We will not obey your law. We will continue to make salt. And we've been inspired by that to do the seed Satyagraha. Every time there's an attempt by government to make a law that would make our seeds illegal, I march to the Prime Minister and say, Gandhi taught us, you can write these laws, but we will not obey because we are governed by higher laws. The laws of the planet, the laws of life on earth, laws of human justice. And it is our duty to save seeds. And you do not have the right to interfere in that ecological and ethical duty of ours. So what we've done is taken these principles and applied them in our struggle for food sovereignty and seed sovereignty and land sovereignty and water sovereignty and the sovereignty of our forests and our biodiversity. And we define sovereignty not just as the freedom of humans who depend on nature, but the river to flow, the bees to pollinate, the soil microorganisms to flourish, the seed to give rise to seed. We are living in a time, and this was brought out very clearly by Walter, that the laws that are being written in our lands everywhere in the world are being written by corporations. They are writing the laws. And democracy, in its mutated form, has become of the corporations, by the corporations, for the corporations, and has stopped being by the people, of the people, for the people. So how do we reclaim our democracy and our freedom? I don't think we can reclaim it only within the limits of representation, given that that representation can always be distorted with the representation of money rather than people. It can only happen by going deeper and wider in where democracy is defined. And that's why I talk of earth democracy. Democracy of all life on earth. That is where we get our strength. Where do the laws of the land come from? From the land. The fact that during a colonial period, land was appropriated and given to sugar plantations does not mean that that wrong can carry on forever and be added with new wrongs. Everywhere in the world, the concentration of land ownership by plantation economies of the colonial time has been undone. We have land reform in India. There's been land reform worldwide. And you know that you can't win the GMO fight alone without reclaiming the land. Now, Walter said something very interesting about Hawaiian law. So, you know, there's the law of the universe, there's the law of the earth, and within that is the law of the people living in and with the land, which is the common law that evolves over time. It's the customary law. The indigenous people, the Aboriginal people of Australia, sued the occupiers. Must have been about 15 years ago, 10, 20 years ago. And they said, you know, you occupy this land, you don't own it. And the interesting thing is, it's called the Mabo case. The judge ruled that these rights of indigenous people and local communities come from natural rights. They are not assigned by the state. The state cannot extinguish these rights. They can, at best, for a few centuries, forget them. Now, the forgetting of those rights to land does not mean an erasure of rights. But the rights of local people are never rights to own and buy and sell. They are rights to serve and defend the land, and the rights to use the land for one's own nourishment. And that's why throughout history, the only land rights that have been there in traditional societies have been usufructuary rights, the right to use. And that's why landholding stayed small, because you can't use too much. Now you've got sugar plantation owners who've stopped planting sugar, making sugar, living somewhere else, selling off their land, leasing it out to Monsanto, illegitimate at every level. So when I heard the beautiful children say, land should be free from the palms of greed, or to save ourselves, we must save the land, we have to take instruction from them. My culture and the Native American cultures, we've always had the idea of the seventh generation. That when you act, think of the seventh generation to come. If we think of the seventh generation to come, the abuse of this land has to be stopped. And I just want to share one tiny example with you. You know, Coca-Cola is another big company. It's kind of the Monsanto of bad drinks that ruin your health. And it was driven out in 1977 from India because of corruption and faking taxes. They were thrown out. And they came back with liberalization. And suddenly they were all over. And they started to drill water. I got an invitation from a village I don't know, get a call from women, come and join us for 1 year of fighting Coca-Cola. So I go down because I'm interested to see how Coca-Cola is related to what they're fighting. Every day Coca-Cola was siphoning off 1.5 million liters a day of water. In this water abundant area, there was a water famine. What remained was polluted water. And then a woman, 6-year-old woman, my lama said, "We can't keep walking further for clean water." She was already walking 10 miles. "This company has to shut down." So they did a satyagraha, camped outside. I went in, I found 500 policemen and 100 villagers. And I said, "No, we got to pitch in and help." You know, I started to mobilize lawyers, political support. And the case went to the High Court of Kerala, where the judge ruled, "This water is neither the property of the state nor the property of Coca-Cola. It is the common property of the local community." And therefore the state does not have the right to hand over the water to Coca-Cola, and the plant must shut down. From 2004 onwards, the plant has been shut down. I'm giving this example because I think it wouldn't be a bad idea to serve notice on the basis of earth law, recognizing the rights of Mother Earth, customary law, the Hawaiian law, both to the plantation owners who are under the illusion they are landowners, and to those who rent the land under the illusion that they can poison without your permission. I know Ken Kawai, through the new recognition of ancient concepts of the rights of Earth and the rights of Mother Nature, you are drafting local food sovereignty principles. Because we are at this watershed. The corporations have defined themselves not just as the rulers of today, but as human beings. They have legal personhood. And this fiction, which is not a person, then pretends it has a mind, and that mind can own all of the life on this planet. So we build fiction on fiction on fiction. It's a house of cards. You just have to poke it a little, it's going to come crumbling down. But to do that, we could apply exactly the same Wendell Berry quote to political action. We have to be skillful, creative, loving, reverential. And there is no reason and no way that people of the world, rising with their new identity as Earth citizens, in solidarity with all life on Earth, and in solidarity with all people anywhere else, fighting against these war criminals who became poison criminals and are now GMO criminals, to tell them, your time is over. We have better ways to produce food. nature and the earth is our first employer. We turn your back. We turn our back. You know, this lady Myla Ma in the Coca-Cola situation, she pulled her two sons that were working in Coca-Cola out and said, it can't be that I walk further for water and you say you're earning some money. Give up your jobs. Come back to the local economy. And I think we need to tell everyone who thinks their bread and butter is coming from Monsanto that there's a local food economy waiting for them to join the creativity of seed saving. Seed saving, organic production, cooking, sharing. We haven't even begun to explore the amazing potentials of our freedom, our creativity, and our power. That's why I've come to join hands with you. I want to return only when you've driven these criminals off this island.
Applause in my water.